Thank you for joining us on Warrior Women Speak. I'm Judge Rosemarie Aquilina, author of Just Watch Me, and I'm joined with my co-host, Sherry Botwin, LCSW, social worker and trauma specialist, and author of Thriving After Trauma, Stories of Living and Healing. We have created this podcast for your enjoyment and so that we all can talk about our issues and learn together about how to deal with trauma and those things that spring up in our everyday life. Please join us for every episode and let us know what you want to talk about. Now for the show. The world was stunned in the death of Tyre Nichols. And it's something that we need to talk about because there is the brutal beating of the 29-year-old Black man in Memphis. And there was rage and almost seeming joy that police assaulted him with. And that really troubles me, especially since I am a judge. I work with law enforcement all the time. I see defendants, and what I see is not joyful. And I have to wonder a couple of things that I want to talk about with you because you're the expert in trauma. And one is, have law enforcement been so traumatized that they are numb as to the people they serve? And the other is, how can we expect the Black community to feel safe? Because it's my experience in my courtroom that when I have members of any minority and there's been an event, I have to really be cognizant and pay attention to what they say, because I know that their feeling is, and I will acknowledge it on the record, I understand you feel you can't call police. Can we get to a way of you thinking that it's okay to call police before you take your own action, because now you are in front of me? But it's a huge leap because they don't feel safe with police. And this is yet another example of police have gone too far. And we have a young, worthwhile man who has a family, lived in a community, was loved by many, who died at the hands of law enforcement.
It's absolutely horrific. And I try to understand what is going on in the minds of these men who are beating on this guy. Like, how do you do that? I mean, I have to be honest, I haven't been able to watch. It sounds like you've watched the video. I chose not to watch this one because when I watched the George Floyd video, what happened, it stirred up so many feelings for me. I've seen like images of the cops and I've seen tiny snippets before I have a chance to change the channel. And that was what went through my head. What could possibly be going on in the minds of these policemen that make them think that what they're doing is okay? How do you treat a human being like that? And you and I were talking about this as we were getting ready to record this show. What have the experiences been for these cops before this happened? What kind of violence have they been a part of? What kind of violence have they witnessed? What's their history that makes them think that treating a human being like this is even remotely okay on any level?
It is fascinating. I do know that I have a number of police officers who are attacked by the public. It doesn't matter what color the public is, or the police officer, corrections officers, fire, all the safety people, even nurses and doctors in emergency rooms have been attacked. And there has to be that fear factor of seeing a hand raised or a certain look where they go into protective mode. But that really signifies to me that everybody who deals with the public where we're in danger, including judges and lawyers and therapists, doctors, nurses, you know, not just the first responders, but anybody who deals with these situations, we all need to not just take a vacation, but have mandated counseling every year to make sure that we are not immune to feeling another human's pain, and that we do understand that we are there to make things better, not worse. And you know, learn to take proper procedures, even though we know them. Sometimes I think you need to hit, you know, reboot like we do on our computers or our phones,
Absolutely.
So that we can reset our own feelings and prejudices, because everybody has some prejudice or some fear that has us say or do things we might not ordinarily do. And if we have this mandated reset time, maybe our world will be better, because there is no excuse for what happened to Floyd or to Nichols. And you're right. Exactly. When I saw Nichols, what did I see first in my head was George Floyd. And I thought, oh no, not again. And my stomach turned.
Yeah. You bring up a good point when you were saying about resetting and about what have these cops experienced in the past and what triggers them. That's a good point, because again, we weren't there, so we don't know what happened. But I think when you work in a field like law enforcement or in the medical field or in the psychiatry or psychology field, we come across and we work with people who have been through different experiences that they have not dealt with. So one of the things that I still have to work on 30 years after speaking up about what happened to me is recognizing what triggers me and what puts me in a state of fight or flight. Because I think, again, when you think about, it's interesting that we're talking about this, because just today I was sitting at a basketball game before we hopped on this Zoom to record, and I had an argument with one of the moms of one of my kids' very good friends. And today I noticed she was at the game. Her son was playing on the other team. I looked at her face, and what I saw on her face looked to me like she was angry, even though we talked and everything is fine and blah, 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 blah. And then she's sitting with all her family members, and I'm thinking, they all hate me now. They're mad. And what I notice is when I see that expression on her face, like looking angry, I get that pit in my stomach and I instantly get in defense mode. Like if she comes over to me, if anybody says anything. And then what I had to do is say to myself, you're writing about this right now in your book, Sherry. You're writing about how part of what you have to do when you've been through earlier experiences with violence is you need to not keep living as if danger is present. You need to be able to place that feeling and recognize, even if somebody's mad at you, you're a 52-year-old woman, you're sitting in a public situation. If somebody comes up to you and lashes out or says inappropriate things, you know what to do. Like I had to sort of talk myself down, but it probably took me about half the game, 30 minutes. That's 30 minutes, which is a long time, to really just say to myself, no matter what happens, I know what to do. And I know that right now there's not any danger. So we don't know what happened when they approached Nichols. And we don't know the story, the history of these cops. And again, it's our responsibility as adults, especially if we're going to work in these types of professions. If we have our own histories of something having happened to us, it's our responsibility to recognize that and take action based on what we know of our history. So if you're going to work in the police force, and I agree with you, there needs to be trainings, there needs to be conversations. Saying to somebody, just take a week off, that does not address underlying issues related to fear and anger and the flight or fight response. That just delays maybe something bad happening because that week that person is not at work.
Well, and you don't know if that person's then curled into a ball on their living room floor because of that trauma. They actually need to have it addressed. It's not about just let's take time off. It's about let's take a time out to address the situation, not because it's some kind of mandated vacation. It needs to be mandated therapy to get at the underlying issues. And as you're talking about yourself, and I'm listening, and you know, we're sort of made the same, because there I have to oftentimes call myself and say, okay, you can't do this. You can't do what you want to do. You can't lash out. But I know you, and I think of myself as well, as to be made of strong moral fiber and try to always strive for the highest integrity level. And sometimes it works better than others, I know. But ultimately, this video with Nichols shows EMS workers failing to render standard of care for trauma patients. And that is troubling. And I see it as active and passive bystander behavior. So we had some active bystanders who actually got in there and caused worse damage, right? Killed Nichols. But there also were passive bystanders who apparently didn't get charged, but they had the ability to call 911. They had the ability to jump in and take their colleague off of him. They had the ability to do something. And what did they do? They stared at it and did nothing, and they don't get charged. But ultimately, I think they're a co-conspirator. And I know that's not the law. It's not what I have to follow in court and all of that, but I see enough of this. And when we have any kind of bystander, whether you're an active or passive, you know, what you need to do is remember people need help, and you are there to participate in helping, not harming. And if it takes calling 911, then do it. Don't just watch it like a movie that's entertaining, because it's not entertaining. It's not entertaining. It's real life. And we have a young man who died. That person is irreplaceable in this world, and this never should have happened. And I know everybody's pled not guilty and they have their day in court, and I'm not commenting that they're, you know, guilty or not guilty or anything, because there's a jury who's going to decide, and the facts will come out how they do. And everyone can say, well, you and I were talking about, well, there's film. Well, film is only part of the story, because film has one angle. And when you're looking at any crime scene or any movie or any situation in life, it's really a kaleidoscope of angles. And you don't know what's happened until you see all the angles. So I don't know what's going to happen here, but certainly the grief, the trauma, the death that everyone's experiencing right now is because of the perception that you can't be Black in America, that you can't rely on law enforcement and first responders. And that is so against the fiber of the America that I know.
And again, it's really frightening when you say that we can't rely on law enforcement, or people are afraid to call the police because they don't trust that they're going to respond appropriately. You know, one of the questions that I have, and again, I haven't really watched the video, I've just seen sort of pictures. One of the questions that I have is, if there weren't five policemen together, sort of working together, what would be different about this story? How could it have ended differently? Because that's one of the things that's striking for me, is that there's five men beating on someone who apparently didn't do anything. And I'm thinking, what is that about? It almost felt like a gang. That's when I heard the story, and when I watched the Floyd video, and when I heard about that story, that's what I'm thinking. And I'm thinking about these bystanders, and I'm thinking, did they not say anything because they were afraid to say anything? I don't disagree with any of what you're saying, but I think what might happen for people, when you say this is not a movie, I think what happens actually for some people when they witness something that's so unbelievable, it actually can feel like a movie. You can be sitting there watching something and thinking, is this actually what's happening right now? Did that just happen?
Well, the video shows several figures off to the side for long stretches, and they're not actively engaging, but they're simply watching, and they sort of wander around. And they occasionally talk to the victim who's in distress, and they do nothing. And then there are those then that harm him. And you are absolutely right. It's a gang mentality. But as we know, it only takes one bad apple in Michael Jackson's world in his song. Remember, one bad apple don't spoil the whole bunch. Well, one bad apple does spoil the whole bunch, right? So you have one bad apple who says, yeah, this is what we're going to do. And we don't have the other one strong enough to say, I'm not doing that. That is wrong. And so we do have that gang mentality. And I don't know if it would have been different if it was one. It depends on which one. And it never should be five against one. You know, it's interesting, because I want to take it just to my own home. When I tell Michael, you know, don't do this, or, you know, get off your sister, or whatever it is he's doing that's not right, and I'm correcting him, my mother will be in the background echoing what I just said. And I will always say to her, two against one, not fair. Let me be the mom. You are the grandmother. You're the second chair. It's fine if I'm not here, but do not gang up on him. She gets mad at me and she says, I'm the grandmother. We live in the same house. I have a right to say something. And I say, no, two against one is never fair. So I have to just extrapolate that and say, why was there five against one? There could have been four in the background, letting one handle it. So it's one-on-one and only doing what's necessary force, but they went far beyond necessary.
Oh my gosh. I mean, from what I'm hearing, there's not any justification or any, there's no reason that something like that would happen. And again, when you talk about the different bystanders or the people who are just sort of going along with it, it makes me really think, is this what you saw? Is this familiar to you? What's going on right now? Is this sort of something that happened in your family? Is this something that you've experienced with your friends? Because again, I don't think that these situations happen for no reason. And I think that even though we as a society, I feel like are working very hard to call people to the, what's that expression? Call people to the, oh my goodness, to the, it's, I'm thinking something. I'm like, it's so
call
not
of action. A call of action. Is that what you're talking about?
Like the step up thing, like calling people to be accountable. I can't think of the word. I'll think.
Accountability is a good word. Let's look at that, because we all need to be accountable for these actions. We need to demand that they stop, that we have changes, and that people jump in and call 911. I'm not suggesting anybody gets harmed. We don't want that. Okay. But you know what? This is a day and age where everyone has access to a cell phone. If you don't have one, go to the nearest person next to you or the nearest bank or store or whatever and say, dial 911. We need to get accountability is an exceptional term and means everything that we need, along with education and treatment for those who have suffered trauma so they don't make others suffer trauma. Because I think that's part of what you're talking about. Look at the history and you will find, and I see it all the time on the bench when I talk to defendants and I say, you have this in your background. Do you suppose that this is why you're angry? And now you've put that anger out in the community or anger out against your father, or your girlfriend or whoever. And so we need to have more of this, but it's going to take not just accountability, but a lot of education. And quite honestly, our government, instead of building jails and prisons, should put some money into mental health treatment and into this kind of awareness into our schools so that kids see that they can come to the table and work it out. They don't have to punch it out.
Yeah. One of the interesting things about the story is this particular branch of the police force in the town where this happened, their main job is to deal with gang violence. So I don't remember what it's called, but there's a force within the police in Memphis that is specifically designed to reduce violence on the streets. And one of the things that I heard about 2 days, 3 days after Nichols' death was that they were going to disband and completely get rid of this branch of the police, because clearly what their mission and what they're trained to do is the opposite of what they're doing. It sounds like that in some ways they have given themselves permission to act like gang members because they're out on the street trying to manage with violence. So that part is very interesting to me.
And I disagree with that, with their thinking. I agree with what you've said, because obviously they were set up as more to be gangsters, to control gangsters, and that's wrong. I can tell you that we have a gang task force in our police departments across Michigan, but in my own community, and they do an exceptional job. The problem is they eradicate one gang group and then another one springs up. But once the gang members know that, hey, you know, we're going to go to prison, we're going to get in trouble, you know, and then it's interesting always, because when I have a gang member in front of me, I always say, look in back of you. And they look at me with a quizzical face and they do it because I'm the judge and I've ordered them to do it and they're in handcuffs. And I say, who's back there? And oftentimes they don't have a parent or family member. Once in a while, they'll have a mom or a dad who shows up. And I say, do you see any of your friends? And they say, no. And I say, they didn't call you. They didn't write you. They didn't send you any money for, you know, a box of Kleenex or whatever it is you need in jail. They're not here either. And so you've supported their bad behavior. You're in front of a judge. You're likely going to jail or prison. And the only one here is your mom or your dad or your uncle, whoever said, you know, stay home, don't get in trouble. And you didn't treat them like family. And so it's these task forces are really good, but the training, the trauma treatment, it has to be very specialized. It's not one where you act like gangsters to get gangsters. That is just a recipe for more murder, which is what we're trying to avoid.
Yeah, and that's exactly what just happened, it sounds like, from what we're seeing. So I'm curious, when you're talking about all the people who were on the scene, because again, I haven't watched the video, there were just regular witnesses, or not regular witnesses, there were just citizens who were witnesses to this. Who was there besides the cops? You said the EMS workers.
The cops, you know, it was one of those things where I almost couldn't look either, but yeah. There were some other people who had their children. And I mean, there were some, as my understanding, but I don't know, right? I mean, people back off. So I don't know how many, I know there were other people. I kind of was so focused on what was there. I'd have to see it again to even look, but I do know that, you know, this causes such PTSD that has this ramification within, especially the Black community, but other communities, that there needs to be some real healing, because for anybody who watched it, whether it was the other responders who did nothing, but also those in the community who just stopped and were shocked, that PTSD, that is secondary trauma that we must address, because, you know, we're not over Floyd yet. And now we've got this. And how do we give people back trust? Because when there's trauma, there is no trust.
Right.
So how do we do that?
And the problem is, if there's two bad cops and there's 100 good ones, once the one bad cop acts in such ways, all cops are bad. That's the problem. That's part of what secondary PTSD is about. It's about thinking, I can't trust police anymore, so I'm not going to ask them for help. Instead of thinking, there are police, there are doctors, there are therapists who are also human beings who also can be very sick individuals. Just because somebody is given a license to practice law or be a doctor or become a police officer doesn't mean that they're going to always make good choices. So I think that we're not talking about that. And I think we need to be talking about that. What happened to all the other people on the scene who did watch, and how many of them now are sitting in their homes thinking, I should have, I could have, why didn't I? Because there's a lot of survivor's guilt, I think, that happens for people when they sort of snap out of the trauma of what they just saw and they realize, I didn't do anything to try to stop that. I just stood there.
Yeah. And the EMS did not, as I understand it, use their training. They didn't use it in Floyd. They didn't use it in Nichols. When there's a head trauma, you have so many seconds to get oxygen to the brain. You don't deprive the brain of oxygen. And I think they probably learned that on day one. And it's a really critical step in helping the patient to recover. And they didn't do that. I mean, they didn't protect the brain. They didn't protect the human. They didn't give them oxygen, which we all need. And, you know, the worst possible outcome happened. I don't understand how you violate your ethics that badly. Now, again, I just got to say it again. I'm not judging them. I'm not the jury. I'm not the judge in this case, but we all have ethics. I have ethics. You have ethics. And I think we have, as human beings, if you're not licensed, you know, where you actually have a list of ethics that you must follow in a guidebook like we do, and we have to take tests on it and learn it, you still have a moral compass. Follow it. If you don't have a moral compass, like, go get one. There's places you can go to get treated, get help, go see your priest, your reverend, your pastor, you know, go dance in the moonlight to whoever you know, Mother Nature, figure it out. We've got to have a moral compass. Find it, use it. I believe in a moral compass, and I don't know how it got so lost and distorted in this world.
Yeah, I don't know either. And again, I wonder what were they thinking? What were the EMS workers thinking? That because this man was apparently being pulled over or arrested by the police, does that mean that automatically they assume that the guy is bad or that he did something wrong? What is going on? Because in some ways, it's almost like they made a choice not to act accordingly, as if this person, Nichols, is less than human. But he is human. And when you say, I'm not here to judge, like you're not, this is not about you being a judge. We're not talking about the trial. We're talking about what it's like to be a human being and our reaction, I guess is how you could say that, our reaction to a story that's just so upsetting and inhumane on so many levels.
Well, and I know you see this. I see it on the bench. I've gone through it in some instances in my life and people I know. And that's where scholars have actually called this linked fate. And it's where we identify with the victim because we say that happened to me, or that could have happened to me, or that happened to my child. Or now I know that my child is going to school where there are gang members, where there are Black children, where there are Black families, where there are minorities, whatever it is, however we've linked this, or people who are gay or bisexual or what have you, and because somebody got beat up in the bathroom. Now we're identifying with that person because we may be of that culture or preference or what have you. And there's fear for ourselves, for our family, for our children. And so we are identifying exactly with that fate of the victim. And that itself is that secondary trauma, thinking that could be me or someone I love. And now you're fearful. And that's, there are people, and I don't know all of the, you know, psychosis that are involved with all of this, except I know you see it, but I've dealt with people who are agoraphobic. They won't leave their house. And it's because of certain traumas like this, they don't know how to re-engage. And it could be something simple like this, because this seems simple, but it's really, really complex.
It's so complex. And as we're talking about this, I'm thinking about somebody that I work with who was abused by people in her church. And again, they, for her, that they are in position of authority. They're in a position of power. And she is somebody who almost 50 years old is afraid to leave her house. She does not go to church anymore. And again, it's not the same exact thing as what we're talking about, but there are similarities, because I think once we are shown that somebody in a position of power could take advantage of that and could use that against us, we will be afraid. And many people, once they've been in a situation like that, their lives are affected forever, for the rest of their lives. I mean, imagine being, because this is one of the things that I was thinking about, all the different people I see in therapy and the trauma survivors who caught wind of this story and what that triggered or stirred up for them, even if their experience was different, even if the abuse that they suffered was different, or even if they're not abuse survivors, but they have felt judged or betrayed by people who were supposed to protect them. I'm noticing today, and I don't know what people are thinking as they're listening, but it's for me, talking about these types of stories is very difficult. Whenever I need to talk about something that has to do with authority figures and they're using their authority to harm others, that triggers me. It just makes, like, I feel sick as we're sitting here. I feel sick inside when I think about when you're given the honor of serving as a police man or woman, or when you're given a license to practice medicine, and you then go and do horrible things to vulnerable people, it literally makes me sick. It just, I don't know how else to describe it, except it makes me sick. Now, I can say now at my age that I recognize that not all authority figures are going to do that. There are great policemen out there. Just yesterday I was in a parking lot dropping some stuff off, and there were about 10 cops gathered around. And my first thought was, what's happening? What's wrong? And then I sort of sat there for a minute and I watched them. I was looking to see if there was a victim or somebody that they were cornering. I think they were just meeting up at that parking lot, and they were smiling and they were laughing, and there was no violence. There was no everybody looking like they were in danger. But for me, just pulling into the parking lot and seeing all these, there must have been 7 police cars and about 10 or 15 of them. I had to sit for a minute and look and be like, is this safe? What's happening right now? And I was actually, I think one of the things I was doing was I was looking to see, are they bothering somebody? Are they harming somebody? Once I could just sort of take a deep breath and say, well, on a gut level, I can feel that there's not anything happening. I think they're actually just meeting up for lunch or who knows what they're doing. Then I could see that my breathing would slow down and I felt calmer because there was a part of me that didn't want to leave the parking lot until I knew it was safe. And I also didn't want to get out of my car.
We're trained that way. I'll tell you, one of the things that I do for my kids, and I don't know if anybody else does this or wants to think about it, but especially once my kids were young, because we see so much of police misbehaving. And I have to say, I love police officers. You know mm-hmm. how much they make? Not very much.
Yeah.
They're lucky they can buy an extra loaf of bread. They don't make a ton of money and they risk their lives every single day for community safety, for all of us. They respond to things that we don't want to see or hear about. I think they're pretty amazing overall. And one of the things I did with my kids and that I love police does is, for example, in our community at Halloween, the kids will have, you know, the Halloween at the police office or the jail or whatever it is. And they allow you to bring in your kids in costume, and they have a little trick or treating, and you get to go into the stall to see the jail, to see the police, to meet the police dogs, which is always fun, and to see how they work and their offices and all of that, so that it's really get to know the community and know that we are people just like you, and you can count on us to show up. And I think those programs are really effective. My kids actually sat in the police vehicle and they were kind of enamored by, you know, what's in there and all the equipment and the dog. And they really learned a lot, but they learned not to be afraid that it's okay to call, because when we have this linked fate kind of idea, and you can picture yourself when you see these bad things walking in the shoes of those other people or your family or friends. And that, you know, don't forget your kids are watching that. They may not comment, but they're seeing that and they're hearing that. We need to make sure that they have the other side of the story, that we flip that script and we know that that is not normal. The news shows us what's abnormal. We don't have a station, unfortunately. Maybe I'll start one if I ever win the lottery.
I was just going to say, right.
Right? The good stories, the good news. Here's a, you know, a good Samaritan. Here's a good police officer. Here's a fireman who did X, Y, Z. And they do this every single day, because then we might have some trust and some accountability there to say, you know, you too can do good, rather than here's the bad and here's the worst.
I mean, I think that's a great note to end on as we're talking about this, is to really think about, of all the awful things that we see and hear as we're trying to process and digest this latest story about Nichols, it really is important to recognize that there are many good things happening in the world that aren't being aired and shown all over social media, because what gets people's attention are stories that have to do with trauma and vulnerability. But I think it is very important to think about, when you think about the police in your community, think about what you know about them or what you see about them. Because again, what I saw yesterday was a bunch of guys just hanging out. They were smiling. They were friendly. They were, you know, not waving at me, but they saw that I was looking and they acknowledged me. There are so many people out there who are in positions of authority who really do what they're supposed to be doing. And some of them go way above and beyond. They're not just serving the community, but they go above and beyond for people. So I think it is important. Maybe,
They do. I think I told you, and I'll just reiterate it. I don't remember if I talked about it on a previous show or not, but I had a police officer who offered, let me help find the wedding rings that this thief had stolen, and took his own time to go and do that for this, you know, 88-year-old woman whose husband just died and her wedding rings were stolen and then tossed in the yard. And, you know, that didn't make a headline, But to that woman, her trauma and what she was going through, that officer is a hero for even offering to spend his time on his day off where he's not getting paid to help. And there are those people in the community. So what you need to do is stay honest and transparent, ask questions, let people know how you're feeling, and make sure that you know that there are safe places where you can get help and you can also get treatment.
I think that's a great place to end, because it's really about recognizing that in this crazy world that we live in, and with all the bad things that are happening, there really is a lot of good that's going on. It's sort of like we had a show that we called Trust After Trauma. That's what this is about. How it's about reclaiming our right to continue to trust people who are in positions where they're there to help us, even when we hear about stories where they don't do the right thing. And for anybody out here who's been taken advantage of, abused, mistreated by, whether it's your parent, your teacher, your coach, to recognize that while those are awful things to have to go through, not everybody is going to be like that. And that's really what heals trauma, is recognizing that you can continue to trust and know that there's going to be people who have your back even after you've been betrayed.
Well, and I have to say before we go, okay, sorry, I need one more word. And that is for the George Floyd. Yeah, I know you always laugh at me, but you know, I got to get my words in. For the George Floyd families and friends, and for Tyree Nichols' family and friends, and for the Black community, we stand with you, we hear you, we see you. And we will help stop this. I think Sherry and I are committed to dealing with trauma of all kinds and getting the word out there so there's a safe community for everybody in the crayon box. We stand together and we all need to be seen and heard and protected.
I love it. I'm so glad that you got that word in, because that's an important thing to be saying. So you get it.
Yeah. So if you like us, please. Listen, review us, pass the word. We're going to end now because Sherry just can't contain her laughter as always. Oh, we're going to see you next time on Warrior Women Speak. Thanks.
Until next time.
Bye.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Warrior Women Speak. It is truly an honor to have conversations that are difficult to have, but that we need to have. Judge Aquilina and myself are so excited to announce that we are now doing speaking engagements in addition to our podcast. To learn more, you can email us directly at warriorwomenspeak@gmail.com. And don't forget to rate and review our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen if you are enjoying what you're hearing. Until next time.